From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, the Greek debt crisis, the prisoner swap in the Middle East, and a former warlord becomes a kingmaker in Liberia. As the European debt crisis escalated again this week, the country worst affected was shut down by a two-day general strike. In Greece, airline flights were grounded, state offices shuttered, and stores closed across the country in the biggest organized protest against austerity measures since the debt crisis began almost 2 years ago. Joanna Kekisis sent this story from Athens as the strikes began.
Even before the call for big strikes, demonstrations had already begun. Since last week, these protesters have occupied the finance ministry, waving Greek flags from office balconies and blasting songs of resistance. On the street below, dozens of public sector workers marched to parliament. "Don't bow your head," they chanted. "The only road is resistance." Many Greeks oppose the latest austerity measures, which include more job and wage cuts in the public sector, as well as a controversial new property tax. But unions have been especially incensed by a provision curtailing collective bargaining rights in the private sector. And they have found a supporter in former Labour Minister Luca Cazzelli. She said the provision could threaten the national minimum wage and the working class. "If the economy falls into a deeper recession, state revenues will fall dramatically," she told Mega, a Greek TV station. "It's our responsibility to point this out to international lenders." The government is trying to negotiate with unions and Katseli, who's still in parliament. She's threatened to veto the provision. Platon Tinios, an economics professor at the University of Piraeus, says unions have long held sway over political parties. He says restricting the influence of unions will help open up the economy at this crucial time.
"They certainly haven't done very much to promote economic growth or competitiveness. They haven't done very much to get us out of the problem, and you can point to quite a lot of things they've done to get us into the problem."
Tinio says unions long prevented reforms now seen as inevitable. Changes to the bloated pension system, for example, or privatization of state assets. Now Greece is bankrupt and has no choice but to change, he says.
"Power is a function of how much leeway you have to influence matters. And Greece at the moment, we have very little leeway to influence anything at all. So one wonders what are the objective of the unions are."
A small group of elderly protesters belonging to a Communist Party union are walking along a busy street in suburban Athens. A man is speaking into a megaphone. "The powers that be are trying to make us into 21st century slaves," he says. Vasilis Langadas, who's 30, watches the group march by. He's not a fan of unions, which he says are corrupt, but he supports collective bargaining because he believes it protects workers. He works at an international mobile phone company and has seen many of his colleagues laid off.
"Tomorrow, maybe I don't have a job. I don't know if I'm going to lose my inner self or something. I'm going to get crazy and jump from the window." No, of course not. But things are difficult. Things are difficult.
He says the protests this week are not just about the power of unions. Austerity is killing the future, he says, and someone has to speak up. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Athens.
Coming up, the prisoner swap in the Middle East, and a former warlord becomes a kingmaker in Liberia. A dramatic prisoner swap took place between Israel and the Palestinians this week. After 5 years in captivity, Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit was freed, as were more than 400 Palestinians, with hundreds more due to be freed in the near future. First, let's go to the West Bank and NPR's Peter Kenyon.
In one corner of the Palestinian Authority headquarters in Ramallah, officials sat on a small stage and tried to rally the crowd. But the speeches were largely drowned out by the cries and tears of families reuniting after years, in some cases decades apart. A mother collapsed into the arms of her son, one of those released today, as other relatives crowded around. Nearby, Fakhri Barghouti tasted freedom after 34 years in jail. He was carried on the shoulders of relatives who believed that his crimes, including the killing of a Jewish settler 35 years ago, were acts of resistance to an illegal occupation. Outside the compound, 12-year-old Batul Abu Eid hugged her newly released father, something she hasn't been able to do since she was two.
I feel like hugging him again. I'm extremely happy to be in my dad's lap.
Her father, Salman Abu Eid, who was an active member of Hamas's military wing before spending the last 10 years in jail, called on all Palestinian factions to unite behind an effort to free more than 5,000 other inmates still incarcerated in Israel.
I call upon the whole world to see the cases of the prisoners.
Palestinian negotiator Nabil Shath says there may soon be high-level talks between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. As the Palestinians work on reconciliation, he hopes Israel will give Hamas-ruled Gaza some room to breathe.
Let they at least start ending the siege of Gaza, which they claimed was done because of Shalit.
On a day when resistance was the dominant theme, a few voices bucked the trend. One belonged to Jamal Tawil, whose daughter remains a prisoner of Israel. People need to realize, he said, that we don't need kidnappings to bring back our prisoners. We need talks and pressure on Israel from good people around the world to bring our people home. But at least on this day, many agreed with Fakhri Barghouti's sister-in-law, Hanan. She sat in the peace and quiet of the olive groves of El Kabar village and with chilling calm said that Hamas has got it right.
The only strategy left for the Palestinians is to kidnap more soldiers. I ask every Palestinian to kidnap a soldier.
Those still wondering if this prisoner exchange can somehow revive peace talks hope Palestinians don't heed Barghouti's call. Peter Kenyon, NPR News.
Meanwhile, images of a pale and clearly shaken Gilad Shalit dominated Israeli television screens as the country celebrated his release. Shira Frankel reports.
The first sight of Gilad Shalit on Israeli soil shows a young, frail man being assisted by some of Israel's top military officials onto a plane. Worry about Shalit's physical health was briefly put aside, however, when photos of a smiling Shalit, embraced by his father, were released. In the foreground of the photo, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu smiles benevolently. That photo has already been added to Israel's national roster of iconic images. Some say the release of Shalit is Netanyahu's crowning moment. In polls conducted in various Israeli outlets yesterday, Netanyahu's popularity soared. Israel's left-wing daily, Haaretz, normally critical of Netanyahu, said he had emerged a new leader after returning Shalit to his family. Hundreds gathered Tuesday at the Shalit family home to welcome the young soldier back from his captivity. They waved flags and posters reading, "Shalit, you were gone far too long. We missed you." When the family entered their home together, the crowd broke out into song and dance, many with tears streaming down their cheeks. Israeli authorities have asked the Israeli public to give the Shalit family privacy in the coming weeks, and a police cordon has been erected to keep curious onlookers from the area. Noam Shalit, father of Gilad, said that his son was happy to be home.
We are, as you've probably seen today, finishing a long ordeal. We thank all those who have helped us. We are experiencing the rebirth of our son. Gilad feels well, though he's suffering from some minor injuries, fragments to his legs that he received while he was captured and were not treated properly.
Physicians who have examined Shalit said he was pale and weak, largely from lack of sunshine and limited physical movement. They said he should recover quickly, and that experts in trauma and stress were on hand to ease his adjustment. For NPR News, I'm Shira Frankel.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. In Liberia, the presidential race goes to a runoff next month, pitting the Nobel Peace Prize-winning president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, against a one-time justice minister and former UN diplomat, Winston Tubman. But it could be a former warlord turned senator who placed third in the election for president who becomes the unlikely kingmaker. From the capital, Monrovia, NPR's Afabia Quist-Ogden has more.
Feeding goats handfuls of greens in his backyard at his home in Liberia's capital, a chatty Prince Johnson consults his election campaign team and advisers. The former warlord, who was elected a senator for his populous northeastern Nimba County in 2005, holds court under what's called a palaver hut in Liberia. That's where you sit and talk. He tells NPR laughingly that he's now in an enviable position politically as kingmaker or queenmaker in the scheduled runoff next month. And last night, the mercurial Prince Johnson announces he's made his decision, backing 72-year-old President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. So why?
Well, the thing is that if you got two evils, you choose a lesser one. She is a lesser of two evils. And she has only 6 years to go. I'll prefer 6 years to support anyone for 12 years.
What he means is that Johnson Sirleaf has already completed one presidential term, and so should she win a runoff, would have only 1 6-year mandate left to serve. Senator Johnson, the now failed presidential candidate, who still has political ambitions, is playing his cards close to his chest, but tells the BBC this is what he wants from the president.
Well, she hasn't offered anything, but what we are most interested in is power sharing. What percentage will be given to our people?
Prince Johnson is likely better known outside Liberia for taking up arms in a rebellion in the late 1980s. He notoriously oversaw the torture and the long, slow death of the late Liberian president and dictator Samuel Kanyondo. Johnson's name tops the list drawn up by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the TRC, in 2009, as the number one perpetrator of war crimes in Liberia. He was never prosecuted and shrugs off my questions about possible indictment by the International Criminal Court.
No, they won't come after me. The Hague has its own lawyers. All of those writings you see in the TRC, incrimination of Senator Johnson, it's all based on prejudice. It's all based on prejudice. No war criminal can win any vote anyway. It's not possible. No, they won't come after me. I'm a liberator.
Prince Johnson is the man both President Johnson Sirleaf and her second-round presidential challenger, Winston Tubman, will have to deal with. It's clear both sides are courting Johnson. Liberia's leader, who was recently jointly awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, says his strong showing in the first round came as a surprise. But she's fine with the prospect of having to work with a former warlord.
I am not uncomfortable with that. After all, he was elected senator in 2005. We will talk to him. We will talk to every one of them.
Johnson Sirleaf, too, was named in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's report. Her critics argue that should exclude her from the top job as president. Her presidential challenger, Winston Tubman, says he's the best man for the job.
What I think we need is not someone who broke the country down, destroyed the roads, and did all the destruction to the infrastructure and the social fabric of the country. I don't think that such a person is best qualified to heal the wounds of the country. All Liberians, we want to put the past behind us. When we take power, if God is willing, that'll be our focus, that all Liberians can live together. Those who did terrible things show remorse and say, well, let's start a new beginning.
It's unclear whether the kingmaker, Prince Johnson, and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf have cut a deal or whether any such agreement would work. Liberians have until November 8th to decide who they'll vote in as their new president in the runoff, the incumbent or Winston Tubman. Afabia Quist-Ogden, NPR News, Monrovia.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.